in your rooms watching this live stream. That was beautiful.
To provide a moral grounding for tonight's teach-in, I'd like to introduce Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, the national co-chair for the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival. Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris is founder and co-director of the Kairos Center for Religion, Rights, and Social Justice, and she's also the coordinator for the Poverty Initiative at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. An ordained minister in the Presbyterian Church, Theo Harris has spent the last two decades organizing among the poor in the United States and worldwide. Liz.
Good evening. How's everyone doing tonight? Good. It's really good to be here in this room with some powerful leaders from across D.C., and it's great to be connected to folks all across the country that are watching watch parties in the different states that are taking part. So I had a particular Bible passage that came into my mind thinking about this evening. And it's from Jeremiah 6. This is a part of it. It says, everyone's after the dishonest dollar. Little people and big people alike. Prophets and priests and everyone in between twist words and doctor truth. They dress the wounds of my people as though it were not serious. Peace, peace, they say, when there is no peace. My people are broken, shattered, and they put on band-aids, saying, it's not so bad, you'll be just fine. But things are not just fine. Do you suppose they are embarrassed over this outrage? No, they have no shame. They don't even know how to blush. There's no hope for them. They've hit bottom. There's no getting up. As far as I'm concerned, they're finished. God has spoken. Over the last 3 weeks, we've heard stories about people's kids dying because of the lack of health care, even though they're living in towns and cities that have some of the most high-tech hospitals in the world. We've heard about communities living with poisoned water. One community in North Carolina told us a couple weeks ago they had had 1,000 days of bottled water because their water was unsafe to drink. This week and other weeks, we've heard about veterans committing suicide at a higher rate than soldiers were killed when deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan. Those stories, people's response to them often is peace, peace. But there isn't peace. Since we've been organizing this campaign, there's been suggested $7 billion of money cut from CHIP. There's been the suggestion of work requirements for public housing. We've heard about unbelievable cuts to SNAP, to LIHEAP. And this was on top of already existing deep and broad poverty, where 62 million people in this country live on jobs that pay less than a living wage, where 4 million households turned on their taps this morning to find leaded water coming out of them, to 53 cents of every discretionary dollar that this country spends is on the military, but only 15 cents for things like healthcare and education and programs that lift the poor up. We've heard about how there's 250,000 people who die every year because of poverty. That's more people who die from heart disease and cancer and strokes combined. And we keep on talking about this number, this 140 million poor people that live in this world, that live in this country. And then when we add it to the folks all across this world who are dying from poverty, the numbers are unfathomable. This is immoral. This is unjust. And this is unnecessary. So Jeremiah 6, that quote I read from the beginning, has a message for us, I think, if we keep reading. And by us, I mean the people, the broken, the rejected, the radicals who believe in justice. He continues by saying, "Stand at the crossroads and look. Ask for the ancient paths. Ask where the good way is. And walk. And you will find rest for your souls." We're at week 3. Thousands of people across this country in more than 30 states, as Sierra was talking, have taken action together over the past 3 weeks. Some folks have stayed up all night in their Capitol buildings. Others have stayed up all night chained to the fences in front of their governor's mansions. Others have been bruised and battered. But folks are finding those ancient paths. They're finding where the good way is. So we focus this evening on the war economy, militarism, and the proliferation of gun violence. That's been the theme of this week. And there are a couple of concepts I wanted to kind of lift up as we make our way through this program. One thing that both our Constitution and sacred texts tell us is that life is sacred. We can find in the Declaration of Independence this idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In constitutions, especially those that were written in the South post-Reconstruction, there's another little clause in there, and it's the right to enjoy the fruits of your labor. This concept of pursuit of happiness, of enjoying the fruits of your labor, of life and liberty, it's about the sacredness of life, and not just American life, but human life. There's also this concept in our sacred text of Imago Dei, that humans are made in the image of God. We've talked in the last couple of weeks about voting rights and how that comes connected to us being created in the image of God, that being able to represent yourself and your political positions is what it is to be in the image of God. We've talked about in the last couple weeks economic rights being linked to Imago Dei, that you can't have life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness if you don't have a job or an income, that everybody needs a house, that everybody needs health care. We will talk in the coming weeks about the link between being created in the image of God and the holiness of all creation, and how life in itself is connected and needs to be lifted up. But this evening, I think what we're going to hear from the folks that are talking is about being created in the image of God is also about an end to violence, an end to war, an end to militarism and anything that takes away the dignity and humanity and life of anyone. And this means, again, in this week of Memorial Day, not just American lives, not just deserving lives, not just straight lives, not just white lives. This is about life being sacred, war being immoral, and us having to stand together and come together to struggle against violence. So I'm really looking forward to this evening. There's amazing folks that are doing deep work on these issues that know a lot for us to learn from. And so we just kind of wanted to bring this framing in terms of what it is that we're doing, why it is that we're doing it, and what it's going to take for us to build a movement that puts people first, that holds up the sanctity and sacredness of life, whatever people's religious beliefs, political persuasions are, and says, we will study war no more.
U.S. homicide rates are 7 times higher than other high-income countries, driven by a homicide rate that is 25.2% times higher. From 1968 to 2016, there were about 1.6 million deaths in the United States in relation to this. Our first speaker this evening is Ryan B. Nickens. Ryan was born and raised in Ward 8 of Washington, D.C. She is the founder and president of the Trayron Center, and that is a nonprofit organization that promotes the well-being of residents of Washington, D.C. who have lost their lives and their loved ones to gun violence through non-traditional counseling service and the creative arts. Ryan's personal experience with gun violence has guided her efforts to ensure families and communities affected by gun violence have resources to deal with their traumas. It was the murders of her Uncle David, sister Tracy, and her brother Ronnie, and her experience with trauma and healing that led her to found the Trayron Center while she was a student at Howard University School of Divinity. She is often called on by faith communities, nonprofits, and organizations to share her expertise on gun violence. Ryan co-chairs the Washington Interfaith Network's Community Safety and Police Accountability Team and represents WIN on the Metro Industrial Areas Foundation Do Not Stand Idly By campaign. Ryan holds a Bachelor's of Arts in Communications from North Carolina Central University and a Master's of Divinity from Howard University. Ryan.
Thank you, Sierra. Thank you all for having me this evening. When I first accepted this, I was ready and prepared to tell you all about my Uncle David, my brother, and my sister. But this past weekend, this past Memorial weekend in Washington, D.C., there were 10 shootings, 5 murders. And one of those shootings was my 26-year-old cousin, who's now in a hospital fighting for his life. And so today, as I kind of prepared in between meetings today, I went and stood beside his bed. He was heavily sedated, really didn't know I was there, and just watched his mom, my cousin, not know exactly what to do. She had seen our grandmother go through this. She had seen my mother, her aunt, go through this, and now here she is with her only son, her only child, and she's trying to figure this thing out. She's trying to stay strong, trust in her faith that her baby boy, her only child, is coming out of this alive. And so as I made my way through this weekend trying to figure out what is it that I share with you all, how do I talk about gun violence that happens in urban communities like Washington, D.C., Chicago, Miami-Dade County, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Memphis, because what's happening is a slow massacre. It's 2016, 135 lives taken, blood running through D.C. streets. 2017, 116 murders. Right now, 2018, 63 and counting. 63 of the murders that have happened in D.C. this year, 10 to 15 of those have been children under the age of 18 who never got a chance to live, who never got a chance to live out their dreams because they were killed. A 15-year-old leaving school in between two elementary schools in Ward A was gunned down in front of babies that have to live with this each and every day. They have to live with gun violence. And then we wonder why reading averages in Ward 8, where I'm from, in urban environments are down and kids are not accelerating in their education as they should because they're suffering from anxiety. They're suffering from trauma and nobody wants to address their trauma. Nobody wants to deal with what life has already dealt them at 4 and 5 years of age. I know this all too well. My uncle was killed in 1989, walking from my grandmother's house to my aunt's house. He was shot twice in his back. He left a one-year-old daughter. And I just remember that phone call, because I don't sleep. I think I've never slept. And I remember picking up the phone, and my uncle said, put your mom on the phone. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. And I told him, nah, what you calling at 2 o'clock in the morning for? What do you want? And he's like, Ryan, I'm not playing. Put your mother on the phone. This isn't a joke. And when I got my mom up and gave her the phone, I heard this wail, this cry that I'd never heard before from my mother. And I looked and said, what happened? She said, David's dead. A couple of years later, an argument between my sister and our next door neighbor escalates. He's high, he's drunk, and he gets a gun and he shoots my mother, my brother, and two of my sisters, killing my 9-month. My sister was 9 months pregnant when she was killed. Couple of years later, my brother's killed. And so I went through my early years severely depressed, suicidal, attempted suicide more than I care to admit here. And so I understand what that's like to go through this life surrounded by death. And my work with the Trayron Center is that we would help children deal with their anxieties, be able to talk about their anger, be able to talk about what's dealing with them, and now helping adults deal with their grief, because it's my belief that we are re-traumatizing each other in urban environments because nobody gets to deal with their grief. You're told to go on. You're told to be strong. You're told all of these things. But then there's the other part, because you got to wonder why 1,807 guns were recovered in the city of D.C. that has not one gun store. Some of the strictest gun laws on the book, but yet 135 people are dead in 2016. So where are the guns coming from? And who are we holding accountable besides the person who pulled the trigger? Who else is being held responsible for all of this? Gun manufacturers, gun store owners need to be held responsible for the blood that runs in urban environments and on our streets. They have to be held responsible, because if someone's stealing guns from your store, then that means you're not, your store isn't being kept safe and secure. And so now my brother's blood is on their hands. My sister's blood is on their hands. My uncle's blood, now my cousin's blood is on their hands. And I think they should pay up. I think they owe it to all of us to stricter rules. I think the gun manufacturers and gun store owners should be at the forefront of this fight for safer guns. And so with my work with Metro IAF, we, and Do Not Stand Idly By, there were some asks of gun manufacturers, because we know Congress is not going to do anything. That's too much money to come out of their pockets. So we asked local officials to take a stand with us, to sign on to the campaign, to look at who, what they're invested in, what companies they're invested in, and to let us come to the stockholder meetings. Not divest, but invest for a seat at the table to begin to affect change from within. And so a couple of weeks ago, a group from Do Not Stand Idly By went to the Storm Ruger shareholders meeting, and we got them to move. We got them to do something. A lot of what happened with Bank of America came from Do Not Stand Idly By. And so if we can hit them in their pockets, we can get the reform that we want. So we are, I encourage you all to go look at Do Not Stand Idly By, the campaign. If your city isn't signed up, 123 states are signed up. And just kind of look at what we're doing and the victories that we've won, and continue to hold the families who have lost loved ones in prayer and in thought. Whatever your tradition calls for, hold them in prayer, hold them in thought, because this is a lifelong journey. It messes with your mental health. It messes with whether or not you will progress, because we are living with children who are hopeless now in urban environments, because for decades they've seen violence take over their lives. And so thank you all for this opportunity. And let's keep fighting. I end these things with, let's go get some justice. All right.
What do we want? Justice. When do we want it?
Now.
That's right. Military spending in 2017 was $668 billion. Discretionary spending on anti-poverty programs was only $190 billion. 53 cents of every federal discretionary dollar goes to military spending, and only 15 cents is spent on anti-poverty programs. Wow, I can't even say that. It's ridiculous. The Department of Defense was responsible for 72% of the U.S. government's total gas emissions in 2016. So like Ryan was saying, it goes beyond the gun violence on the streets. It also affects our environment and affects our mental health. The next speaker will be Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Working as a writer, activist, and analyst on Middle East and UN issues, she is also a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. In 2001, she helped found and remains active with the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. She works with many anti-war organizations and writes and speaks widely across the United States and around the world as a part of global peace movement. She has served as an informal speaker and advisor to several top UN officials on the Middle East and US, or United Nations, democratization issues. Phyllis has written and edited 11 books. Soon, she will be publishing the updated edition of her popular Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict. Phyllis.
Thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you for an extraordinary introduction to the question of where we are and what happens in this city. That's so important. It's so important when we think about our work as global that we not forget the local, that we not leave behind what happens here. I'm going to do something that Reverend Liz told us tonight not to do, which is to study war. Study war no more. We're going to study war a little bit because you have to know your enemy in order to stop it, right? So if we want to stop war, we've got to study war. We've got to know how war happens and why and where and to whom. So let me start with a question, if we're going to do sort of militarism 101, right? How many of you work in your ordinary political work on specifically anti-war campaigns? A few. How many of you work on either anti-racist, immigrant rights, environmental justice, economic justice, labor rights, housing rights, the anti-racist movement writ large, or any other movement? Everybody. Okay. So here's the challenge. It's to talk about why the question of war and militarism is relevant to the anti-racist movement and the movement against poverty, and the movement for environmental justice, and all of the movements against Islamophobia, for LGBT rights, all of them. Because militarism is not only about the war economy in this country. It is that. And it is, in that way, derivative for the others, because militarism causes poverty. Militarism causes environmental degradation. Militarism and war cause refugees and the anti-immigrant and Islamophobic kinds of policies that we see in this country. Militarism is linked to racism. Across the board, war and racism are the intersecting evils. And what's so important about what Dr. King taught us 50 years ago at his Riverside speech was that you can't talk about ending war unless you're ready to get up and talk about ending poverty and ending all of the evils that go with it. He talked about the three: racism, militarism, and materialism. Almost forgot. And we added climate because Dr. King would have, certainly, and because we must, because of the world that we live in. But it isn't only about that. It's not only about the cost of war here and that 53 cents out of every discretionary federal dollar that goes directly to the military and therefore doesn't go to build housing, to create alternatives to violent police, to solve the problems of racism and poverty and militarism in the broad sense. The reason we don't have any money for that is the money that goes to the military, the 53 cents out of every discretionary dollar. But imagine if it was free. Imagine if we could have 15,000 troops, as we do now, stationed in Afghanistan, killing Afghans every day, and it didn't cost us a dime. Would that be okay? I don't think so. Because the cost of war at home is different than the cost of war abroad. We will hear from Jose and others perhaps later about the impact on veterans, which goes far beyond the physical injuries that they come home with. It includes moral injury. But we also have to recognize the injury, the death that we cause to people around the world. Because our military is not deployed to bring peace. No military is. In that way, our military is no different. The job of every military is to kill people and break things. I said that once at a briefing we were doing at the Pentagon, the first and last time I was ever at the Pentagon, let's be clear. But somebody who was in the room, a rather high-ranking person, sort of goes, "We prefer to call it kinetic activity." And I said, "Okay, fine, call it kinetic activity, as long as we're clear that the job of the military means, kinetic activity means, to kill people and break things." And they said, "Yeah, okay." So I said, "Okay, then call it what you want." It's not about what you call it, it's about what happens. It's about the lives that are lost, the wedding parties. The U.S. military seems to have a, a tradition of attacking wedding parties in Iraq, in Afghanistan, other places. The children, the journalists, the doctors who are slaughtered. The cost is enormous. And militarism is rooted in the very beginnings of our country. If we look at the work of the great historian Howard Zinn, how many of you have read Howard Zinn's great, you all know it, People's History of the United States? And one of the things that Howard taught us was that there are two strands to the history of our country. On the one hand, we are a country grounded in genocide and slavery. But we are also the country that is grounded in movements against genocide and slavery, and that from the beginning there have been people who fought back, who said that we do not want to live in a country that is made rich and powerful by genocide and slavery. So we have to hold up both of those histories, both of those intersecting legacies, recognize, acknowledge, and take responsibility for the evils that has been done in our name by many of our ancestors, while at the same time holding up the heroes of those who went before, standing on their shoulders to say, no, we are also the country that builds movements against those evils. So let me go for a minute to the studying war, the hard part. Everybody take out your pencils. Because this is important. The question of the economics of the war economy is crucial. It's not the only part. It's not the only part about morality or anything else, but it is really important. 53 cents out of every discretionary federal dollar is a huge amount of money. So what does that mean in terms of the real impact? If we look at just the example of Washington, D.C., and I refer you all to the great website National Priorities Project, where you can do all this research that makes people like me sound like we know what we're talking about when we really just looked it up right before coming over here. But it's hugely important. Washington, D.C. alone has spent over $17.6 billion of our tax money since the global war on terror began in 2001. $17.6 billion. It's an unfathomable amount of money, right? I don't even know what a million looks like, let alone a billion. $17 billion is way more than I can comprehend. But here's what we could have done with it over those years instead. We could have paid for 182,000 elementary school teachers for a year. We could have created 317,000 infrastructure jobs here and in places like Flint, Michigan, to rebuild the water system. We could have put more than 2 million kids into Head Start. What makes us safer? Jobs and healthcare and education, or slaughtering people across the world who never knew what hit them? I think we know the answers. Why is there such support for this? Why does the Congress allow this to happen? We have members of Congress in the Progressive Caucus, in the Black Caucus, who are committed anti-war in their approach, who are anti-poverty, who are against environmental destruction, who are anti-racist, and yet they will vote for military spending. Not because they are bad people, because of the one conspiracy theory that I really believe in. I really don't like conspiracy theories, but there's one fact of our history. I've never been able to come up with another reason. So I accept the conspiracy. Here's the conspiracy. After World War II, when the military-industrial complex is starting to kind of reconvene and figure out, okay, now we're not at war anymore, what are we going to do to make a lot of money? Well, they did something that any producer, any manufacturer will tell you is exactly wrong. They created a system of producing stuff, whether it was B-52 bombers, whether it was the bombs that kept dropped, whether it was anything, and they said, we are going to divide where we go to produce that stuff all over the country. So we're going to make one little widget here, and we're going to put those widgets on a plane and fly them over there, where they're going to be attached to another little widget made in another congressional district. And therefore, every member of Congress has jobs in their district that depend on the wars. And that's why members of Congress are still doing this. The question of militarism goes way beyond history. It goes back to the slaughter of Indians. It goes back to the question of slavery. All of that was made possible by militarism. Westward expansion was made possible because the guns in the hands of European settlers were stronger than the arrows of the indigenous people who once held that land. That's why they lost that land. The guns were stronger than the arrows. So if we're talking about the legacies of intersecting war and racism, the Indian Wars are the best place to start. Colonel John Chivington, who said, kill them all, nits make lice, kill the children. That is what we're hearing from Israeli officials who talk about Palestinian kids. That's what we're hearing in practice from racist cops who kill our kids. This is the reality of the intersection of militarism and war. And as I finish, I want to just say that we have to keep in mind always what's so difficult, to remember that beyond what happens in our own communities, to the poorest among us, the most vulnerable among us, the people of color among us, the LGBT among us, the immigrants, Muslims, all of the most vulnerable of our communities, the most vulnerable of our sisters and brothers. It is our sisters and brothers around the world who are paying an even higher price, who are facing the wrath of a military which has no beef with those people, but kills them because that's what militaries do. And the price is paid by the veterans who come home with moral wounds that will never heal, as well as physical injuries and mental injuries of all kinds. The communities that lose their first responders because they're sent off to fight somewhere. And who are they fighting against? They are fighting against people, poor people like us. Poor people are once again the victims of wars. The war against poverty here targeted poor people. The war against Afghanistan, the war against Iraq, the war against Yemen, against Syria, against all of the countries where these wars are going on today, they are targeting poor people. And we need to stop them all. Thank you.
In 2016, CEOs of the top five military contractors earned on average $19.2 million each, more than 90 times the $214,000 earned by a U.S. general with 20 years of experience, and 640 times than the $30,000 earned by an Army private in combat. More than 68% of the civilian casualties in 2017 in aerial attacks were women and children. Nearly half of the female military personnel sent to Iraq or Afghanistan reported being sexually harassed, and nearly 25% said they had been sexually assaulted. In 2012, suicide claimed more military deaths than military action, and as of 2016, September 2017, an average of 20 veterans died by suicide each day. Our final speaker, Jose Vasquez, is the training director of Veterans Organizing Institute and the former executive director of Iraq Veterans Against the War. He served 14 years in the U.S. Army and was honorably discharged in 2007 as a conscientious objector. You can clap for that. He is currently pursuing a PhD in cultural anthropology at the CUNY Graduate Center, conducting research on militarization and the politics of veteran status in contemporary American society. Jose.
Thanks, Sierra. I only have a few minutes, so I'm going to try and be brief. So I want to start by saying that I come from a military family. My dad is a Vietnam vet. He served two tours in Vietnam, and that had a huge impact on my childhood. I'm from the South Bronx. I think my dad had a really hard time transitioning back to civilian life. I grew up in a household with domestic violence and alcoholism and poverty, definitely. Eventually, I was raised by a single mom. Mom decided to split up the family for the sake of her children and the kind of traumatic situation that she was facing being around my dad, who was, you know, struggling with his experience. So despite all of that, I still decided to join the military. I think my reasons for joining had everything to do with growing up in poverty, both in New York City and the Bronx, and then again in Los Angeles when we moved across the country. I was in high school when the Rodney King riots happened, and I think that for me, just getting out of that environment was really important. Also, the military recruiter was really the only person that was knocking on my door to offer any sort of opportunities. So to give you a sense of how dedicated he was, he drove me to summer school every morning to make sure that I graduated. And so I signed up for 4 years in 1992. I did 4 years active duty and then 10 years as a reservist. The story of how I became a conscientious objector is going to probably be too long, but what I will say is that I was living in New York City when 9/11 happened, and it really, you know, shook my thinking to its core, and I really started to think about, you know, why am I in the military and who am I going to kill? Once it became clear that we were going to Afghanistan, then I had a lot more questions. Well, why are we bombing these poor people who probably had nothing to do with what happened on September 11th? And once the Bush administration started talking about Iraq, then I really saw it for what it was, that this war had nothing to do with liberating anybody. It had, you know, the only thing we were there to liberate was the oil that was under the ground in Iraq. So after a lot of soul searching, and particularly after the Abu Ghraib scandal, and seeing those photos and really kind of hitting home that, you know, being in the military doesn't always necessarily mean that you're one of the good guys. And that's what I told myself for many years. At that point, I'd been in the military for about 12 years and had no reason to question my military service. But I think seeing those photos and the reality of American soldiers torturing Iraqi civilians who may or may not have been combatants, I think was had made a really indelible impression on me, particularly one photo where an American soldier is holding a German shepherd to a man who's wearing an orange jumpsuit. His hands are tied behind his back. It's one of the few images from the Abu Ghraib scandal where you can see the person's face, the facial expression. And that just spoke volumes to me. You know, to see an American soldier holding a dog, particularly a German shepherd, reminded me of, you know, the Nazis. It reminded me of the civil rights movement, the use of dogs against folks who were doing civil disobedience and the police using dogs. And so to me, after seeing those pictures, putting on my uniform meant I was the bad guy in the story, that the narrative had completely changed for me. So I joined an organization at the time was called Iraq Veterans Against the War, which started in 2004. And we're now called About Face Veterans Against the War. We changed the name to include Afghanistan vets and any other folks. We're in war in seven different countries right now. So just being called Iraq Veterans Against the War didn't fully capture the experience of our membership, which is unfortunate that we had to do that to expand that. But it also is telling of how long these wars have been going on, how many different places people have been deployed to. And the movement is growing. There's a lot of soldiers and vets that are waking up from their experiences and really starting to connect the dots. I think, you know, being told one thing when you deploy and then seeing the reality of it when you're deployed and overseas and actually having an opportunity to speak with people in Afghanistan, people in Iraq, it really has a huge impact on people, right? And they start to connect, you know, their experience maybe coming from a rural community and then being deployed to a rural community and sort of seeing community life and how, you know, what we're being told about the civilian populations in those countries and then actually talking to those people are two very different things. So I'm hopeful, right, that even somebody who is part of the military machine, part of the problem, can still see their shared humanity with folks, you know, who are supposed to be the enemy. You know, in my study, I think a lot about militarism and militarization, right? And I one of the lessons I try and impart to people is that we have to think about those two things as being connected, but very different processes. So what I try and tell folks is that militarism is an ideology. It's a way of thinking, right? It's a way that informs how those that ascribe to militarism see the world, right? And from the perspective of militarism, the military is the solution to every problem, right? One example of how militarism affects our culture, excuse me, is the response to the Kaepernick protests in the NFL, right? The way that someone who is trying to draw attention to the issue of police violence and the lack of accountability with the police with respect to the black community and our country was doing something that was connected to the national anthem and the flag. And immediately, right, the response was, that's disrespectful to the flag, which represents the troops that have died, right? And that doing that is somehow desecrating their sacrifice and what they've done for the country, right? So you can see that that way of thinking, right, immediately connects it to, oh, well, you're disrespecting the soldiers or the troops. Meanwhile, there's lots of veterans. You know, there's a whole hashtag, veterans for Kaepernick, right? Or I'm with Kaepernick. Not all veterans think that way, right? In fact, a lot of them will say, I signed up to protect the Constitution, which clearly protects the First Amendment rights of Kaepernick to do these things, right? So on the other side, militarization, right? Militarization is a process. It's a process by which this way of thinking infiltrates institutions within our society, right? A really powerful example of that is the 1033 program, which basically takes surplus military equipment that often we will sell to other countries, but whatever we don't sell, we then give it away to police forces here in the United States, right? So when you saw pictures from Ferguson or from any other city where we have large protests, why do they have these huge tanks and they look like they're going into battle? Well, it's because the equipment and the training is coming directly from the military, right? So any police force around the country, you know, large or small, can request of the Department of Defense, we need body armor, we need Kevlar helmets, we need, you know, large vehicles, tanks, whatever the case might be, in order to combat terrorism, right? So even in some small town in Iowa or Indiana, right, they can request this kind of equipment, which is absurd. The other thing the military does, along with police forces, is they send police officers to Israel to get trained on how to control a population of people, right, which is what the Israeli government and the military is doing with respect to the Palestinian people. So you can see that this logic, right, not only informs foreign policy, but then how do we take those lessons and bring them right back home, right? So as more and more people face unemployment and, you know, are getting kicked out of their homes, you're going to have this huge population of people that are unhappy. And from the perspective of the government and the military, we need to control those people, right? And if we don't have their consent, then we have to use coercion, right? And so as the powers that be start to lose their grip on having the consent of the governed, they always have the option of violence. And that's what we're seeing every day in our communities, right? Through the police, through the military, along the border, right? Shooting people that are refugees, right? Literally refugees coming to seek asylum, right? Shooting them at the border, separating them from their children, detaining children at military bases, right? So from my perspective, this is why we need a Poor People's Campaign, right? All of these issues. All of these issues are connected, right? I mean, it's almost like they're making it easy for us to unify across movements, right? When you start to detain immigrant children on U.S. military bases, now what you're saying is, hey, immigrant rights groups and anti-war folks, you need to start working together and talking to each other, right? I want to say a little bit about Memorial Day, which just passed this past Monday. And you know, I think it's important to recognize the sacrifices that people have made. I think that if they don't join for poverty reasons, then I think a lot of people join the military for what they understand to be good reasons, right? They think of themselves as serving a higher purpose. They're sort of putting themselves on the line to protect their community, their country, so on and so forth. And I have some empathy for that. I think the problem with things like Veterans Day and Memorial Day is that we often focus almost entirely on the experiences of soldiers and vets and completely blank out what happens to the civilian populations overseas, right? So it's really incumbent upon us to not only think about how soldiers and vets are killed or traumatized, but, you know, for every one soldier, there's 10 civilians that have either been killed or traumatized or have to deal with the legacies of war like Agent Orange or depleted uranium, right? So just because the troops come home does not mean that the problems and the Pandora's box of issues that they've opened up in countries overseas, that continues when we go on, right? There's a campaign now still dealing with the issue of Agent Orange in Vietnam, right? All these years later, there are still children being born with birth defects. In Iraq and Afghanistan, the issue of depleted uranium, same thing. Soldiers are coming back. Their children are being born with deformities. And, of course, the people of Iraq or Afghanistan or all these other places are dealing with that. You know, the cancer rates in Iraq have skyrocketed 600% since the U.S. military has been there for all these years. So I think that we can't lose sight of the civilian casualties. And if you look at the history of war, it's always poor people, women, children, old folks that are the victims of war, and we can't forget about that. There are very few memorials, right, to those people, right? Anywhere in this town, you can find a memorial to dead soldiers, right? And I think that's important to do, but I also think it's important to memorialize the people who are the victims of war. So in closing, why we need a Poor People's Campaign? I think we're stronger together. I think our issues are deeply connected. Dr. King understood this 50 years ago. We understand this now. We're picking up taking up the baton and moving forward with it. And enough is enough. I feel like our politicians are benefiting from war. And as Phyllis said, the military-industrial complex, the corporations that learned how to profit from war, have figured out how to keep our elected officials who are supposed to be representing our interests under the thumb of their agendas, right? They know how to make the campaign contributions. They know how to introduce legislation that is going to impact their business and allow them to continue making money. We need to expose that. We need to show that even cutting the military budget by 5%, 10% is going to benefit millions of people across this country and around the world. I think I'll leave it there. All right. Right on.
There was a member of Veterans for Peace yesterday in Sacramento, California, demonstrating with us for the 40 Days of Action. And in that demonstration, he said, "In the wealthiest country to ever exist, no person should have to pledge the allegiance to the military-industrial complex." The truth is that instead of waging war on poverty, we have been waging war on the poor, at home and abroad, for the financial benefit of a few. It is morally indefensible to profit from perpetual war. We have the right to protect our communities from the ravages and weapons of war. Knowing this, the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival, demands an end to military aggression and warmongering. We demand a stop to the privatization of the military budget and any increase to the military spending. We demand a reallocation of our resources from the military budget to education, healthcare, jobs, and green infrastructure needs, and strengthening a Veterans Administration system that must remain public. We demand a ban on assault rifles and ban on the easy access to firearms that has led to the increased militarization and weaponization of our communities. We demand the demilitarization of our communities on the border and in the interior. This includes ending federal programs that send military equipment into local and state communities and ceasing to call to build a wall at the U.S.-Mexico border. We demand an immigration system that, instead of criminalizing people for trying to raise their families, prioritizes family reunification, keeps families together, and allows all of us to build thriving communities in a country we call home. Yesterday, we said that we won't be silent anymore. And the truth is, we can't be inactive anymore either. So please, if you haven't already, sign up to join the Poor People's Campaign by going to poorpeoplescampaign.org, following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and bringing a friend. And to close us out, we're going to have Sharon Rebar from the Cairo Center and Doc Powell from the Malcolm X Drumming and Dancing. Thank you.
All right, y'all. So what we've heard tonight is that we know there's another way that's possible. We know that we're ready for a different world to exist, and then we know that we need to make that change. So I'm going to ask you all if you're able to stand up with us. And this song is a bit of an affirmation and a commitment. We know we're in the middle of 40 days of action, and we're going to sing this to one another tonight. I want to be ready for change to come. Yeah? So we'll get us started. And you, those that know it, can join right in. The rest of you will catch on. I want to be ready.